An undocumented immigrant who spent 100 days in a Tempe church walks out today. But his case is not resolved.
We're not done because until the president's order is sorted out the logistics, he's going to be kind of still stuck. Can't get a work permit, so we still have work to do.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, reaction to the appeals court ruling in the Deborah Milkey case. ASU students have a new way to get their prescriptions filled.
Should the city of Phoenix get out of the hotel business?
Some West Side businesses worry about their bottom line during light rail construction.
And if you build it, you'd better hope they come.
There's a couple very brave developers that went out there and took a risk, and they've been paid off so far.
Plus, we perform the feats of strength.
But if we win, we probably won't brag about it.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's just cloudy right now around the valley, but for tonight, we're expecting up to possibly 3/4 inch of rain with lows in the mid-50s. Then for tomorrow, cloudy all day with showers and a chance of storms and a high of 64. In Valley traffic, an accident I-17 northbound at Jomax is causing a pretty heavy backup. Meanwhile, eastbound lanes of Interstate 10 and Tempe have reopened after being closed for about 7 hours following a fatal accident. The Arizona Department of Public Safety says a woman in her 20s who was a passenger in an eastbound car traveling at high speed around 6 a.m. Friday passed away. The woman was killed when the vehicle struck the concrete median wall and then collided with another car near Baseline Road. The name of the woman has not been released yet.
A new report ranks Arizona 17th in the nation for its efforts to prevent teen smoking. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie has more.
The report was issued by a coalition of health groups, including the American Lung Association and the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. It found that 14% of Arizona high school students smoke. The national average is just shy of 16%. Wayne Tormala is with the Arizona Department of Health Services. He says that while Arizona's number sounds high, the state has seen a decline in the number of teen smokers.
Even though we're at 14% now, we were at 17% just a couple of years ago. We still feel like, you know, we have a long way to go, but we feel really good about the progress that's been made in recent years.
Tormala said that in the last few years, the smoking rate among adults has dropped from around 20% to 16%. He says that represents some 200,000 Arizonans who quit smoking. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
A judge presiding over the civil rights lawsuit against Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's office has been asked to reopen the case's fact-gathering phase to explore misconduct allegations against some of the sheriff's officers. The U.S. Justice Department told the judge the investigation into whether officers inappropriately took items off people stopped during immigration enforcement efforts is relevant to the federal government's lawsuit against Arpaio. The misconduct allegations are being investigated as part of a separate lawsuit by immigrant rights advocates in which another judge has ruled the sheriff's office racially profiled Latinos in regular traffic and special immigration patrols.
Yesterday, the Arizona Court of Appeals ordered a lower court to dismiss charges against a former death row inmate. As KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, Deborah Milkey was previously convicted of arranging the murder of her son.
Deborah Milkey spent more than 22 years on death row before the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals set aside her conviction. After that, Arizona prosecutors wanted to retry her. Then the Arizona Court of Appeals determined the state couldn't retry her because it would be double jeopardy. One of Milkey's attorneys, Lori Vopel, says Arizona law on double jeopardy is broader than the federal law.
Here in Arizona, under the Arizona Constitution, egregious forms of prosecutorial misconduct can then form the basis for a dismissal under Arizona's double jeopardy clause.
The court determined the state knew about alleged misconduct by a former Phoenix police detective and didn't disclose it to Milkey or her attorneys. Retired police detective Armando Saldate Jr. was being investigated for his interrogation methods and honesty. The court ruled this affected Saldate's credibility, which was important because the prosecution in Milkey's case relied on his testimony. He testified that Milkey confessed to the murder, but she denied making the confession. Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery says courts treat police and prosecutors as one entity, the state.
For purposes of how courts rule on these issues, they're conflating the police department and the prosecution agency. I think it does bear, and it would be fair, to distinguish who did what in terms of qualifying or characterizing what the prosecutor actually did.
Montgomery is appealing the case to the Arizona Supreme Court to make a determination on whether Milkey can be retried. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
For another perspective, we turn to Mel McDonald. He's a former Maricopa County Superior Court judge and U.S. attorney for Arizona. He's also a partner at the Phoenix law firm which represented Deborah Mielke, although he was not involved in the case.
Part of the Court of Appeals decision focuses on the passage of time. And part of that delay is what I think got the Court of Appeals sufficiently agitated that they felt the double jeopardy had attached.
Do you think it was more of the passage of time and less of the potential misconduct from the detective, or were they equally sort of part of what the court ruled?
I think it was the conduct of the detective light years more than the delay. The delay was only one of the factors. I think it was that plus the court's belief that the prosecutor should have been way more aggressive in investigating this officer's background, looking at the internal affairs files, and ensuring that there was not evidence that was available that could impeach his credibility, which there was.
Well, so as a former prosecutor, I mean, how much responsibility does the prosecutor have to make sure that police officers or detectives or other law enforcement personnel that are being called to the stand to testify are actually telling the truth and that they're not hiding something that needs to be turned over?
There is an enormous responsibility on prosecutors, especially in a death penalty case, to make sure that there is not exculpatory evidence that may clear a defendant that's in the police files. It's almost a proactive duty.
Do you get the sense that there are other cases that this particular detective testified in that maybe defense attorneys are going to be pressing for new trials for?
Well, quite candidly, the problem is the detective has been so long away from the force. Might it happen? Yes. But when this case first came about years ago, I think that sent up a flag that if you represented a client that was involved with this detective, you may want to revisit the case. I noticed the Court of Appeals didn't rule or decide on the question of guilt or innocence. The finding was not so much we find her innocent. The finding is the evidence is so damaging and so undermines the credibility of the detective that it's unconscionable that it wasn't turned over to the defense a quarter of a century ago.
I'm curious about what you said about the court not ruling on guilt or innocence. I mean, is that almost secondary in this case? I mean, it sounds kind of strange to say in a court case that whether a defendant is guilty or innocent is almost not the point, but is that the case here?
Had there been a retrial of Deborah Mielke, that would have been the issue. But in this case, the conduct, according to the panel of the Court of Appeals, the bottom line is that what is involved here is the gross misconduct of the state, which denied fundamental rights to Deborah Mielke, and it is so damaging that they're not going to force her to go back a quarter of a century later and try to now retry the case.
Mel McDonald is a former U.S. attorney for Arizona and Maricopa County Superior Court judge.
It's been 100 days since Luis Lopez Acabal took sanctuary at Tempe's University Presbyterian Church after deportation proceedings against him had begun. Today, he's walking out of the church. Reverend Eric Letterman of University Presbyterian explains what has changed.
Well, it's been a group decision, so we've been in contact. Obviously, we've been talking to his attorney, Ray Ibarra. We've been having conversations about, you know, his safety. Obviously, my concern is about his safety, and of course, his desire and his wife's desire for him. You know, can we wrap this up? What does this mean? Is he going to be there at the church forever? And our hope was no. Obviously, we're hoping for something more formal, like a real stay of removal from ICE, but that just didn't happen. But the presidential order allows for people to basically, well, be safe. So in the order is our instructions to the local ICE officials and enforcement officers to not deport anyone who could qualify for deferment, and even though those policies don't go into effect until January. So we believe that he is safe, and we have received word from the local ICE office saying that, yes, we think he may qualify as well. He is not one of the three priorities. He's not even on the list anymore. We're good.
Eric, over the last 100 days, what has the reaction been of the congregation? When you and I spoke in the summer, there was a conversation about what went on behind the scenes leading up to the church offering sanctuary to Luis. In the time that has passed, what have you noticed? What have you heard? Has it been low-key or has it been intense?
I don't know if intense is the right word. We've obviously been engaged in conversation, and we will continue to be in conversation about this. I think it's something the congregation, I think most congregations need to talk about. We have a scriptural witness to welcome strangers and to welcome the immigrant and treat them as one of our own. So how do we do that when one of our own is being told you're not allowed to be here anymore? So I think we still need to have that conversation, and how we are going to be a part of it. I don't know what that's going to look like. I've listened to many people say, you know, I was really upset when this decision came, and then I met Luis, and oh my gosh, this has been an incredible opportunity for us as a congregation to really be reshaped by an incredible young man.
Where do Luis and his family go from here? Do you expect to keep in close touch with them?
Yeah, we're not done. And so even though he is going home, so he's going to go home and he's going to live at home, we're not done, because until the president's order is sorted out, the logistics, which may not be till February, March, we just don't know. He's going to be kind of still stuck, can't get a work permit. So we still have work to do, and we're trying to work with ICE, the local ICE office, to offer some sort of temporary relief to him so that he can hopefully go back to work and begin helping his family.
Reverend Eric Letterman of the University Presbyterian Church in Tempe. This afternoon, Luis Lopez Acabal left University Presbyterian. His lawyer, Ray Ibarra Maldonado, says Luis is no longer at risk for deportation.
So this is an example of what can happen when people across denominations, across ethnic groups, speak different languages, come together for one common cause, and that is family unity. To be able to live in your own community, to live with your family without fear of being deported, without fear of being arrested.
Attorney Ray Ibarra Maldonado talking about his client Luis Lopez Acabal leaving the sanctuary of University Presbyterian Church after 100 days.
About 300 dentists are offering free care today and tomorrow at the 3rd Arizona Mission of Mercy at Veterans Memorial Coliseum at the State Fairgrounds. Oral surgeon Pat Rabat is the clinic director and president of the Central Arizona Dental Society, which puts on the event. I spoke with him earlier from the event.
If you're willing to wait in line, you can get free dental care.
How many people are you expecting today and tomorrow?
Well, the two-day event has been growing. This is its third year. 2 years ago, we saw about 1,200 patients. And then last year, we saw about 2,000 patients. And this year, we already hit the 900 mark about 10:30 this morning. And so we're going to see some significant more patients this year than we saw last year.
How many dentists and other support staff do you have there?
This is really supported locally and from people throughout the state. We have about 300 dentists, and these are not only general dentists, but specialists, oral surgeons, endodontists, periodontists, and prosthodontists. There's a whole gamut of all the specialties of dentistry. We also have a large group of their assistants and hygienists, and then a lot of people from the community that actually has come out to help us out. So we've got about 300 general dentists, and we have probably about 1,500 or more volunteers that are the assistants and then the community people that come in and help us out.
Who shows up to get this free dental care? What kinds of people do you tend to see?
Well, let me just say that most of these are low income. We do demographics at the end. We capture data. Low income or no income patients, people that are just down and out, many that don't have any jobs. And so they come in, they wait in line, and this is their only dental visit in the entire year. Arizona is kind of an outlier in many ways as far as dentistry goes. In a recent survey, there's up to 30% of the population in Arizona have never seen a dentist, which I find amazing when I heard that. But it's pretty significant, and I'm not sure why that is.
Do you find that the patients who come in are there for more routine visits, maybe just a checkup, or do some of them have really significant problems that, were they of a different nature, they might actually go to an ER kind of place?
Most of the patients here, because we asked that question, most of the patients here have been to the emergency room at least once in the past 12 months.
For dental problems?
For dental problems. Yes, specifically for, that's what we asked, specifically for, have you gone to an emergency room because of a dental problem in the last 12 months? And it's incredible on how many of these patients that do that. Very few patients come here just to get their teeth cleaned.
Pat Rabat is clinic director at the Arizona Mission of Mercy, which runs until 6 o'clock tonight and from 6 a.m. until 6 p.m. tomorrow at Veterans Memorial Coliseum at the State Fairgrounds.
A new report says the U of A Medical School has a bigger impact than a huge football game we hear a lot about.
The economic impact every year is like hosting two or more Super Bowls.
That story's coming up on the show. Good afternoon. In Valley traffic, the big news of earlier this afternoon was that eastbound lanes of Interstate 10 and Tempe have reopened. They were closed for about 7 hours following a fatal accident. Valley weather for tonight, chance for rain, especially after midnight. Look for overnight lows to be in the mid-50s. Then for tomorrow, should be cloudy all day with a chance for showers and thunderstorms. A high of 64, then mostly sunny Sunday with a high of 63. It's currently cloudy and 77 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Wells Fargo on behalf of the Phoenix Boys Choir, presenting A World of Carols, a family holiday concert and an enactment of Twas the Night Before Christmas. Five concerts through the 21st. Boyschoir.org.
After spending $350 million to build a downtown hotel, the city of Phoenix might sell the building for a massive loss. As KJZZ's Steve Shadley reports, at least one official says it's time for the city to put the Sheraton on the market.
The Sheraton in downtown Phoenix is Arizona's tallest hotel at 31 stories. It has 1,000 rooms, and it was built next to the Convention Center complex at 3rd Street and Van Buren in 2006. The city got $350 million in bonds to cover construction costs, but the hotel still hasn't made a profit.
I think we should divest ourselves of this operation. It's just not a situation that works.
Phoenix City Councilmember Jim Waring. He says the hotel is too big, and on a good day, it's only half occupied.
Unfortunately, we're still losing money hand over fist, and it's just not an acceptable situation when we've got to worry about other things, fire, police, parks, etc.
Waring estimates the hotel has lost $30 million since it opened, and it'll likely bleed millions more within the next 5 years. He wants the city to put the Sheraton up for sale. Paul Blue is Phoenix deputy city manager.
Since the Great Recession, the Arizona hospitality market has taken a stronger negative impact than the country writ large and our region in the Intermountain West specifically.
Despite the financial losses, Blue says the city made a good investment in the Sheraton. He says the private sector wasn't willing to build a hotel near the convention center, so the city stepped in hopes of making downtown vibrant.
As the convention center thrives and grows and improves, it's imperative to have a headquarters hotel like the Sheraton available to have the services that the conventioners require, or else they cannot come to Phoenix.
Blue says without the downtown Sheraton, the Valley wouldn't have been able to get the Super Bowl and the NCAA Final Four. He says it's time for a private investor to come in and make the hotel work. If Phoenix sells the Sheraton before 2016, it will have to pay huge fines under terms of the mortgage. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Real estate plays such a big role in the Valley's economy, and one area experts are looking at is commercial buildings, specifically projects built without tenants already in mind. Pete Bolton is Executive VP and Managing Director of Arizona Operations for the brokerage firm Newmark Grubb Knight Frank.
There's too much office space available still throughout Maricopa County. So what you've got to look at, Mark, and what we all look at, is we look at submarkets. And really, the only submarket that's building spec office buildings right now is out in the Chandler-Price Road corridor. There's just a mass out there. And so there's a couple very brave developers that went out there and took a risk, and they've been paid off so far, because there's a lot of folks moving to that submarket, a lot of good talent out there to hire.
Who is looking to move into those kinds of buildings? I mean, are those new companies to the Valley or to that submarket, or are those Valley companies that are looking for sort of a new shiny building?
Both. There was one of our clients had about 25,000 square feet over off of I-17 in the 101 area, and couldn't really find it to what they wanted in spec buildings that were available. So they ended up moving to that area and taking about 53,000 square feet. So Chandler, Tempe area gained and West Phoenix lost. But most of those structures are build-to-suits and not spec buildings.
What's the difference?
A spec building comes from the word speculative, meaning it's a true crapshoot. We're going to build this building and we hope we can fill it. Build-to-suits, give you a great example, GoDaddy was in a spec building at the Scottsdale Air Park, kept growing, and took over the entire structure, and then they decided a few years later they need their own building, and they went out to Tempe, Mesa, Chandler area and built 150,000 square foot building to suit exactly what their needs are.
So if companies like GoDaddy are moving from one office building to another, and there are other companies that are already in the Valley that are moving even to some of these spec buildings, are we finding that there is sort of a glut of older, smaller office buildings that are vacant in the Valley now?
Oh, yeah. Well, to some degree, there's a number of 20,000 square foot structures that were full during the 5, 6, and 7 era boom. And there's a number of those that are virtually empty now. Yeah, and what's happened, Mark, is they've become functionally obsolete. And what we mean by that is today's requirement is to put more people in the same area. And so what do you need to do that? You need parking.
Generally speaking, in your mind, what can one tell about the state of the Valley's economy based on the number of these either build-to-suit or speculative buildings that are going up and maybe are up and not occupied?
In office, we're way overbuilt. I mean, at this point, not that it was overbuilt in 07, it's just that it's been an absolutely disastrous market for a whole bunch of years. So what can you tell about the Valley? I would say that you can tell that business expansion is finally back. If the building that company's in, and like I said earlier, they're in 25,000 square feet and they want to go to 50, sometimes it's not available in the building they're in, so they've got to move. And the good news for them is there's plenty available.
Would you expect that the way things are now to continue for a while, or do you see some kind of change coming down the road?
Yeah. So in 2012, I did a talk, and the title of it was more. This is for forecasting 2013. More of the same, but better. I could have used at the end of 13 exactly the same phrase, more of the same, but better. And guess what? That's what we're looking at for 2015.
Pete Bolton is Executive Vice President and Managing Director of Arizona Operations for the brokerage firm Newmark Grubb Knight Frank.
The issue of how we get around is something that affects almost everyone in the Valley. We live in the sixth largest city in the country, and as we grow, so does the congestion. One way Phoenix is addressing the problem is through the development of a light rail system. But as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports in the next segment of our transportation series, some businesses say they're paying the price for progress.
If you drive along 19th Avenue between Bethany Home Road and Dunlap, you know what a mess it is. Bright orange and white barricades line sections of the road. It veers from one side to the other with cones and traffic panels serving as dividers. Keep left and keep right signs at some major intersections help guide traffic into the proverbial gauntlet. There are a lot of moving parts on this stretch of road, and all of it is due to Valley Metro's northwest expansion of the light rail. Unfortunately for some businesses, there's still at least another year to go before construction wraps.
It's not good at all. It's not good. It's drained out a lot of business from the shops. We came down from 5 employees all the way down to 2.
Boris Babachayev owns B's Barbershop on 19th and Northern. He says since construction started in 2013, business has been down about 60%.
Everybody's got an hour of break for lunch or something like that. Nobody's got 45 minutes to waste on traffic, you know, and then 15-minute haircut, and where's the lunch?
Babachayev says he and his neighbors are trying to hang in there. But even when the light rail starts rolling, he isn't confident he'll see a payoff.
I don't think it's going to help my business, and I don't think it's going to get better. I just think it's going to get back to what it used to be.
Patrice Dwyer is another light rail skeptic.
I don't know. I didn't see where it did anything on Camelback. A lot of those businesses are still closed.
Dwyer owns Shamrock Shoe Repair on Glendale, just a few blocks west of 19th Avenue. Even though she's not front and center, she says the construction is hurting her bottom line.
Business is down probably 75%.
Both Dwyer and Babachayev are owners of mom-and-pop shops. You've probably never heard of them, unlike, say, Bookman's, a well-known bookstore on 19th and Northern.
I feel like we've had kind of like amazingly good business despite some of the traffic obstacles that we've had outside.
Katie Spratt is with Bookman's Phoenix. She admits they've seen a dip in business due to construction, but nothing like what Dwyer and Babachayev have experienced. Spratt also says Bookman's has had a positive experience working with Valley Metro, the city of Phoenix, and the light rail contractor. Neither Dwyer nor Babachayev can say the same.
They try to reach out and say, okay, we'll help. How are they helping? You know, they're like, oh, we'll give you a designer, but you pay for all your own prints. You know, how am I supposed to pay for all my own prints if you guys drain business out of here?
Susan Tierney with Valley Metro.
We really try to set the expectation that this was going to be a challenging time.
As a result, Tierney says Valley Metro partnered with other organizations, including the Phoenix Chamber of Commerce and Local First Arizona, to provide businesses with planning and business resources. But
if an individual business wants to create their own flyers or create a special flyer, the individual business would be responsible for the cost of reprinting or printing materials that support their individual business.
While Tierney is realistic about the price of progress, she says Valley Metro has done everything it can to ease the burden.
There is going to definitely be a shift in businesses along a light rail corridor. We saw that in the first 20 miles, but we've also seen the positive side of that, the economic development, the residences that have been built.
With the holiday season here, Valley Metro is trying to make life a little easier for the businesses. They've temporarily halted construction at the major intersections. Tierney says the move should help shoppers access the stores lining 19th Avenue. As for the business owners, they'll just have to wait and see. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz was in the Valley yesterday to talk about STEM education for some students who typically are not involved in that kind of education. KJZZ's Andrew Bernier was at that event and spoke with Secretary Moniz. Andrew, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
So what did he have to say about the kinds of energy technologies that Arizona should and could be using down the road?
Sure. Well, when I spoke with Secretary Moniz, you know, he kind of gave a blanket approach to the steadfast all-of-the-above options that the administration has consistently been saying that that is going to be their approach. He did emphasize that he is supporting a very carbon-reduced approach to energy production. Of course, in Arizona, what that typically means is looking at solar, renewable energy, and, of course, with the Corporation Commission, that's been a point of contention. But in terms of what the DOE, the Department of Energy, has under their power, it's been a lot towards funding and supporting projects as such.
Of relevance to Arizona, I would say that we make investments in solar across the entire innovation chain from basic research to deployment. In the state, through our loan program, we have three very, very large solar projects totaling over 700 megawatts.
U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz and Andrew Bernier, he was not just talking about energy in Arizona, but obviously some of these systems are connected throughout the region and throughout the country, right?
Absolutely. One of the pieces of conversation that oftentimes gets swept under the rug is efficiency and how we actually move energy around. So not just how we make it to begin with, but how it actually does it get from the power plant to your house. And so one of the major technologies that's getting pushed is this idea of the smart grid. So how is it that we can more efficiently move energy around and try not to have it be so isolated from one or two power plants in any given region? And so what I did is I asked him what are some of the benefits in terms of moving towards improving technology for the smart grid.
What we are looking at is the infrastructure of the future, resilient to multiple threats simultaneously. Extreme weather is one, physical attacks, cyber attacks, all of these issues we are now trying to bring together.
U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, KJZZ Science and Innovation Correspondent Andrew Bernier, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
Indiana Jones may have used a bullwhip and gun, but the tools of an archaeologist are most commonly a trowel and measuring tape. But that may soon change. Archaeologists in Britain are pioneering a new scanning technique that means they can uncover ancient relics without lifting a spade. The BBC's Julie Peacock reports.
Old Sarum was originally an Iron Age fort, which stands 2 miles north of the city of Salisbury. Archaeologists have known for centuries that there was a medieval city at Old Sarum, but until now, no one knew what it looked like. So the team from Southampton University decided to experiment using a form of radar so they didn't disturb the popular tourist site. Christian Strutt, one of the archaeologists behind the project, says it works by sticking electrodes into the ground.
We have a couple of techniques that we applied. So we used one called earth resistance, where you pass electrical current through the ground and it measures the variations in the resistance. So if you've got masonry walls, they'll show a high resistance. If you have just soil or ditch fill, then you'll have a low resistance.
The result is something like an X-ray or photograph of what lies beneath the ground. And the team uncovered the entire urban plan for the city. It showed the remains of a once bustling medieval town. They found houses, courtyards and kilns. Christian Strutt says the technique is exciting and innovative and could help historians discover even more about ancient sites without causing any damage.
The good point about using these techniques is rather than having to do blanket excavation and destroy the archaeology as you're recording it, we could potentially target different areas with small trenches to answer our very specific research question.
The team are hoping to use the technique again when they survey the rest of the site in 2015.
That's the BBC's Julie Peacock.
Just ahead, Arizona is apparently a humble place, at least according to one report.
You guys share what needs to be shared, but you don't necessarily swamp your social channels with status updates about how awesome you are, and I think that's a good thing.
That story, it'll be, you know, okay. Still to come, it's the show.
Good afternoon with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, there's an accident on the 51 northbound at the 101 that's blocking the off-ramp. Also a collision I-17 northbound at Jomax, causing a pretty heavy backup. Valley weather, pretty drastic change coming our way tonight. 3/4 inch of rain possible after midnight. We're looking for lows to be in the mid-50s. Tomorrow, cloudy all day with showers and storms and a high of 64 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 30%, cloudy and 77 at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic Cancer Center, where teams of experts work together to care for each cancer patient as an individual. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jim Hawk. The U.S. Senate has until midnight Saturday to approve a compromise $1.1 trillion spending package that the House narrowly approved last night. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says it's time to end 3 years of budget showdowns.
Since 2011, we've lurched from crisis to crisis, with the country constantly under threat of shutdown or financial catastrophe. It's a very bad habit, and the American people are very, very tired of it.
President Obama is reiterating his support for the spending bill, saying it was, by definition, a compromise. With the crucial holiday shopping period well underway, Steve Beckner of Market News International says a new survey is showing that Americans are motivated to buy.
If consumer spending is the lifeblood of the economy, consumer confidence helps make it circulate. And the latest readings are encouraging. The University of Michigan's Index of Consumer Sentiment is up a startling 5 points to 93.8 so far this month. That's the highest level for the closely watched gauge of how Americans feel about the economy and their own prospects in nearly 8 years. The survey of households on which the index is based found greater optimism about jobs and wages. Lower fuel costs are also making people more upbeat. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Wealth inequality is widening in the U.S. According to the Pew Research Center, the wealth of white households was 13 times the median wealth of black households in 2013, compared with 8 times the wealth in 2010. The gap between white and Hispanic households, the highest it's been since 2001. A French court says Uber's ride-hailing service may infringe French law and is ordering the company to make changes to its popular mobile app-based service. However, the court did not ban the popular service, which was launched earlier this year in France. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
Arizona has a shortage of medical professionals, but the increased presence of the U of A's medical school in Phoenix is one of the steps intended to remedy that. And today, an economic impact study of the med school and the Phoenix biomedical campus it's a part of was released by Paul Umbach of the firm Tripp Umbach.
There's really three parts to a medical school economic impact. One is the actual operations of the school. The second is the actual healthcare part of medical education. And the third part is the actual going out and creating the doctors and other healthcare professionals for the future, and that has an economic impact.
Paul, let's go specifically to the University of Arizona. Based on the studies you've done, how great is the impact?
Just by itself, with the other entities that are part of the University of Arizona, it's almost $1 billion in economic impact annually. So in 2013, 2014, was $962 million that circulated in the state's economy because of the presence of the medical school here.
There has been a real strong effort made to try to retain those medical professionals here, but that has been a real challenge, and that is something we're still struggling with here. Are there suggestions in the report? Are there ways of figuring out to make that impact even greater by having those professionals stay here?
One thing that I think is important to understand is that the operational impact can be measured early. The construction impact can be measured when the construction happens, but the workforce impact is much more in the future. There's only been a few classes that have graduated from the medical school. Those students are still right now in residency. So the fruits of this investment in terms of doctors in Arizona hasn't yet been realized. So we took a look at the economic impact in 2025. The reason why we're looking at a future impact for the whole campus of about $3.1 billion is that it will take time for the graduates to actually go into practice.
Paul, you know, there are always some who are skeptical when they hear about an economic impact study because they hear them when it comes to how much money the community draws from tourism, for example, with the Super Bowl coming up. How do you make it so the study really makes sense, is understandable, and people can actually see it? Okay, I understand what the people doing the report are getting at.
It's pretty straightforward that right now there's about 7,000 jobs, both directly and indirectly, related to the University of Arizona Phoenix. The economic impact every year is like hosting two or more Super Bowls. While the Super Bowl is important, and two Super Bowls seems like a lot of money, the quality of the jobs that are created in an academic medical center is about twice as many dollars per person as in retail or in the entertainment industry or in what I call tourism industry.
Paul Umbach of the firm Tripp Umbach.
Nowadays, we use social media not just as a way to keep in touch, but also as a way to look after one another. A friend who suddenly stops posting on Facebook could be cause for concern, and noticing a change in tone in her tweets may cause you to reach out and see how she's feeling.
Jordan Bates, a graduate student in ASU's Center for Policy Informatics, has come up with one way to begin identifying language that could be a cause for concern. He did this as part of a team at ASU's Hacks for Humanity event in September. The team created software that scans social media for language that could be troubling so that others can reach out.
We all have had personal experiences, maybe friends or family that we know that have struggled with depression or instances of suicide. Personally, someone that I had gone to high school with was posting on Facebook prior to committing suicide, making some indications of distress.
Bates says the software was modeled after already existing programs.
It was inspired by a project that's in use right now in Chicago that monitors Twitter for cases of foodborne illness. So when someone tweets that they have food poisoning, the service will then respond to them and say, oh, I'm sorry that you're not feeling well. Could you report it to Chicago Department of Health? Here's the link. So we thought that that idea could be applied to other situations.
And the software has a unique name, ARC Humanity.
I was thinking that we might relate the name to SOS, the Morse signal for distress. And at the end of the message, there will be the Morse signals AR to signal the end of the message, and then K to signify that they're waiting for a response. And those letters together, ARK, form the word ARK, which is also a word that means a place of refuge. So we really liked the connection with the idea that when someone is tweeting a message like this in a public venue like Twitter, they don't want it to, you know, just have dead air. They want some response.
Bates says there are a lot of potential uses for the application, and the team plans to work on refining the software with mental health professionals in order to make it as effective as possible.
Engineers at IBM have produced what they're calling a supercomputer the size of a postage stamp. The new chip breaks away from the traditional way computers are designed and instead copies the human brain. That means it's built up from artificial neurons, a million of them in fact. Here's the BBC's Jonathan Webb.
This is a field known as neuromorphic engineering, taking design principles from the brain and applying them to computers. The aim is to learn from things the brain does really well, like seeing and hearing huge amounts of information and extracting the important bits in real time. Traditional chips, which are still based on the 70-year-old design of Hungarian inventor John von Neumann, aren't much good at this. They have separate components for memory and processing, which leads to a traffic jam where information goes between the two. Dr. Dharmendra Moda from IBM's research labs in San Jose, California, explains that his team took a much more interconnected approach.
Now, what we have done is we have taken this tiny little neurosynaptic cores, each like a tiny little neural network, and interconnected them on a chip. As a result, our chip integrates computation, communication, and memory very closely, thereby eliminating the von Neumann bottleneck.
Altogether, there are over a million neurons, each of which connects to 256 other neurons elsewhere on the chip. This is a long way behind real brain cells, which can send up to 10,000 forward and backward connections, but it's pretty good for a postage stamp-sized copycat. Sophie Wilson, a well-known British computer engineer, pointed out that chips like this will also need a whole new type of software.
At the moment, one of the chief problems that we have is how do you get programs to run on spiking neural network simulators. We can't necessarily write in programming languages for them, though there are some around. So having high-performance spiking neural network models may be a bit early for that.
So they won't be in your pocket or perched on your nose tomorrow, but computers with components copied from your brain are definitely on their way.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Webb.
ASU has become just the second university in the nation to put in vending machines that dispense prescription drugs to students. The machine from a company called InstiMeds is intended to help fill the void created when the Tempe campus pharmacy was closed in September. Christiana Moore is Associate Director of ASU Health Services.
We're confident that this new mechanism provides an innovative and important improvement in medication delivery. The secure new mechanism provides students with greater access to prescribed medication, and they now have the ability to use their health insurance plan to pay for medications. And students will also have the opportunity to access the medication between weekends and lunch periods, which they weren't able to do before.
What medications are available? What kind of medications from InstiMed, and how is that determined?
The top 50 most commonly prescribed medications to students. And so those medications will include antibiotics, asthma medications, antihistamines, probiotics, anti-nausea, smoking cessation products, and vitamins. The machine will not dispense narcotics or controlled medications. And so medications that are dispensed through the InstiMeds machine at ASU are safe and non-habit forming.
How does the machine make sure the right student's getting the prescription? Are there any other security measures we should know about?
After the student's appointment with a health services provider, they will be issued a personalized security code that is good for a 24-hour window. The student will input the security code into the machine along with their date of birth, and the medication will be dispensed to the patient securely. While in the machine, the medication is scanned 3 times prior to dispensing to ensure precision and accuracy.
And how confident is a university that this won't be abused, that there won't be someone who may steal someone's Social Security number or prescription number and then get access to medication they're not supposed to have access to?
All of the students who utilize the machine will first have a meeting with their health services provider. And so only those patients who come and meet with a healthcare professional at ASU Health Services will have access to that machine. And once they complete their visit, they will receive a voucher that is only good for that 24 hours. After they receive that, they will go to the machine and they have a personalized security code that they will enter into the machine. And so we're very confident that those security features, along with the fact that there are a number of cameras attached to the machine, will be a secure option for vending and dispensing medication.
Christiana, have you developed policies yet, or are they in place for how often you might review to make sure that the system is working well, that there might be modifications, or maybe that things are just working swimmingly?
The machine went live 3 weeks ago, and so we are currently in the process of reviewing all of the features that go along with the machine in addition to utilization from students. And we have received positive feedback from the students at this point in time and warm reception in terms of their level of satisfaction with the machine.
What if a student has further questions about a prescription? Many of us know if we walk into a drugstore, we can go talk to a pharmacist if it's a prescription or a medication we've never used before. Is that option available with the machine?
It is. At the time that the medication is prescribed, patient education materials will be provided to the student on how and when to take the medication. And the InstiMeds machine actually has an attached phone to it that will allow the student to immediately access the pharmacist with any questions regarding the dispensed prescription.
Christiana Moore is Associate Director of Arizona State University Health Services. Christiana, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Arizonans apparently like to keep our good news to ourselves, at least according to Hey Let's. The iPhone app has come out with a list of the most and least humble states, and Arizona comes in the top 5 most humble. Justin Parfit is Hey Let's founder and CEO. I asked him why he even looked into this.
It was more to understand how people are using social media. Our platform is all about sharing the positive experiences that you have and making them available to anybody else. Whereas on Facebook, people might sort of say, oh, I got taken out by my girlfriend to the fantastic restaurant. And that's not really a recommendation. We think of it more as a bragamendation. So we were trying to understand the distinctions and how our platform was different from existing social channels. And this seemed like an appropriate survey to do. And it was fascinating to see the extent to which people use Facebook and Twitter and so forth to basically enhance their reputation and their status with their friends.
So what specifically were you looking at when you were looking at different social media accounts?
So, well, primarily Facebook, because that's the one that everybody uses, although we did do a little bit of research into Twitter and so forth. And what we found was that the sorts of bragamendations people would share were an amazing trip that has been on, you know, look at me, here I am on this beach having a fantastic time. Don't I have an awesome life? And then it would be some sort of, oh, I've just been given a fantastic promotion, you know, or my wife has just got me these flowers. And the way we see it is this, is like, you can't have that person's vacation. That person's wife is never going to give you any flowers. And you're not going to have that person's career. So these kind of status updates really aren't helping anybody out. And that's where Hey Let's comes in, because all the content that's shared on Hey Let's, you can actually go and experience yourself.
So Arizona comes in as your 5th most humble state. What exactly does that mean?
Well, I think you should probably pat yourselves on the back for that.
Well, we couldn't do that, could we? I mean, that would make us bragging, right?
Well, no. I think a little bit of self-congratulation that you keep to yourself is
okay.
Probably okay.
The way, look, I'm English, and so obviously, to my way of thinking, you don't want to be sort of coming off as super brash. So I would say, you know, in Arizona, you guys share what needs to be shared, but you don't necessarily swamp your social channels with status updates about how awesome you are. And I think that's a good thing.
Justin Parfit is CEO and founder of Hey Let's. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Most people have heard of the Hatfields and McCoys. Arizona has its own version of a violent family feud that lasted nearly a decade. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us north and tells us the story.
The Pleasant Valley War has several other titles, including the Arizona Sheep War. There have been discussions about how it started, often believed it was over sheep herding. Did you know the war was really a feud between two families and had little to do with sheep?
No, it was just a series of guys murdering each other is all.
Mick Woodcock is the chief curator at the Charlotte Hall Museum in Prescott.
It just seems to me that there's a number of different things involved, and a lot of it's just personalities and prejudices.
Woodcock says the conflict started in the early 1880s. The Tewksbury's were cattle ranchers in Pleasant Valley, near the Mogollon Rim. The Graham brothers worked for them. Around 1884, two ranch hands from the nearby Stenson Ranch entered the Tewksbury property looking for lost cattle, and a gun battle ensued. Woodcock says the case ended up in county court, 200 miles away, in Prescott.
The Tewksbury's think that a lot of folks didn't like them because they had Native American blood. Then there's cattle rustling and horse stealing and brand altering.
The Grahams decide to work for Stenson with the condition the brothers would accuse the Tewksbury's of stealing cattle. And they did. The Tewksbury family was indicted and found not guilty.
They have the trial. The Tewksbury's and their associates are found not guilty. But the judge indicts the Graham brothers for perjury. So in the next 3 years, eight more men are killed on both sides.
A short time later, a Tewksbury and another man were ambushed and killed. In 1887, the war reached a boiling point when a Graham was killed. Then they retaliated, killing several men at the Tewksbury Ranch, followed by another shootout at the family's cabin. The Pleasant Valley War ended around 1892 when a Tewksbury kills the last Graham in Tempe. He's tried and acquitted.
No one in this whole episode is ever found guilty of anything. Never serves any time.
Woodcock says it has been difficult to determine exactly how many people died during the Pleasant Valley War. Some estimate there were up to 35 killings. He says area ranchers and residents in and around Pleasant Valley were drawn into the family feud, taking sides. By the way, that Tewksbury cabin that was shot up by the Grahams sits at the Pioneer Living History Museum in North Phoenix. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things we should know that make Phoenix unique, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
A new holiday was born. A Festivus for the rest of us!
Festivus, the made-up holiday introduced in a 1997 episode of Seinfeld by George Costanza's father, Frank. It's since gained something of a cult following to the point where it's practically become a real holiday.
Wait, it's not?
No.
Then why do I have an aluminum pole in my living room?
Well, it does involve an unadorned aluminum pole instead of a Christmas tree.
Downtown Phoenix celebrates its own version, spelled, of course, with a P-H-O-E prefix. Now, to celebrate Festivus the Seinfeld way, of course, you've got to have an airing of grievances.
Any more grievances? Do you have any grievances you want to get off your chest?
There's an actor serving as a kind of grievance MC, trying to get people to channel their inner Costanza.
So I'm Shelby Matisic. I'm the artistic director of the Broly Theater Company, and we're out here hosting the airing of grievances for this year's Festivus.
This woman complained that her dog won't stop pooping and peeing on the rug. It's an inconsiderate dog.
And then there's the feats of strength. In Seinfeld, it involves wrestling.
But here, core CrossFit takes it to the next level with challenges like planks and high jumps.
Do you want to try one of the challenges?
Yeah, I could do the squat, maybe.
All right, so all we're going to do, we have to hold it for a minute. So you're going to go into this position right here.
It's not
And the creators of Phoenix's Festivus added their own tradition, local shopping. Festivus goers can buy a number of gifts for whichever holiday.
I'm Velvet Deshawn, and I do hand-spun yarn, hand-dyed yarns, and hand-knit hats, scarves, ponchos, gloves.
Deshawn is sitting in the middle of the market mayhem, calmly spinning wool into yarn on a large wooden wheel. Hundreds of shoppers are squeezing between the stands. Business is booming for the vendors at this unorthodox celebration.
This is my third year at Festivus, and it's the one event that when the email goes out in September that they're taking applications, you send it in like that hour.
The event started out with 25 vendors 5 years ago, says founder Ken Clark. Now Clark says 130 vendors will be there over two nights, plus more than a dozen food trucks, and they're still creating new traditions.
We had tonight the first ever Festivus 0K race.
So grab your sneakers and your grievances, because Festivus comes back Wednesday evening.
It's a Festivus miracle!
You can join the celebration in the parking lot at the Phoenix Public Market on Central Avenue and Pierce Street.
If you have already aired all your grievances and competed in the feats of strength, other good stuff to do around the valley this weekend. The annual Carefree Christmas Festival runs all weekend. 35 tons of real snow. Not sure how well that's going to do in the rain.
Annual Tamale Festival is at Food City downtown all weekend. You'll have dancing, mariachi music, I'm sure a heck of a lot more.
The Phoenix Comic Con, it's usually a summer event, but it's back for the weekend at University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale.
The Nutcracker Ballet opens tonight at 7:30. Phoenix Symphony Hall runs all the way through December the 28th.
You can run or walk in the Fiesta Bowl Half Marathon and 5K. It winds through downtown Scottsdale. That's Sunday morning. Also, I know where Steve will be. The Ultimate Fighting Championship comes to Phoenix for the first time. It's at U.S. Airways Center tomorrow afternoon.
Goldstein v. Brody in the Octagon.
Ooh, that sounds really bad to watch.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, and Alexandra Olgan. Tracy Greer, Maria Springs, Aubrey Abril are our digital team. The managing editor, Al Macias, and executive producer is the esteemed John Hope.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Air your grievances about the show. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD, a service of the Maricopa Community Colleges. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. It's 3 o'clock.